Welcome to the Little Red Podcast, which brings you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. I'm Graham Smith from the Australian National University's Department of Pacific Affairs, and I'm joined by my co-host, Louisa Lin, former China correspondent from BBC and NPR, now at the Centre for Advancing Journalism at Melbourne University. We're on air thanks to support from the Australian Centre on China and the World.
China's recently had a moment of reckoning about its urban-rural divide, highlighted by the ubiquitous COVID tracking data. One active case was a migrant worker who'd come to Beijing to search for his missing son. His data showed how he worked odd jobs at all hours, sleeping just a few hours a night between his jobs collecting garbage and on construction sites, all necessary to support a family of six, including his paralyzed father. It was a stark contrast to another recent Beijing case, an urbanite whose contact tracing data showed a life revolving around ski resorts and luxury shopping malls. These cases highlight the massive divide between China's wealthy urbanites and its peasants, as they're still officially called. China's peasants were the backbone of its revolution, but is there still a place for them in Xi Jinping's China?
To discuss the urban-rural divide, we're joined by Mindy Schneider, an assistant professor of development sociology at Wageningen University, and economist Scott Rozell from the Sriman Sprogli Institute of International Studies. Scott's book, Invisible China, draws on decades of fieldwork, and, full disclosure, for his pains, he even marked my PhD thesis. Scott, let's start with some background from your book. You found that in 2015, 70% of China's rural population hadn't finished high school, and there was an astonishing divide when it came to health issues, with almost half of the rural children in South China suffering from intestinal worms. How bad is life for Chinese peasants compared to their urban counterparts?
Well, 70%... it's of the labor force, so this is 18 to 65. It's not that they haven't finished high school. They've never been to one day of high school. If you compare China to all the other middle-income countries in the world that have been trapped for the last 6 years, China has the lowest level of education of any of those countries. I would say they're number one low. Today, urban children all go to high school. A majority of them actually go to college now. Even though many, many more rural kids are going to high school now, these are 15 to 17-year-olds, not 18 to 65-year-olds, are going to high school now. Most of them are in these vocational high schools that, you know, the quality is pretty low, and they aren't getting the skills they're going to need, you know, for the future. So that's not talking about health, and it's not just intestinal worms. It's anemia. It's myopia without glasses, okay? And it's early childhood development problems that last through their whole life. So it's a whole spectrum of problems. And this is the bulk of China's future, that they're supposed to build a high-tech, high-productivity, high-skilled economy around. But, you know, I just don't see how it's going to happen.
Scott, could I just hone in on one particular bit of research you've done? And that was where you went to Gansu and you actually measured where children were at in a cognitive sense. I think it was 13 to 14-year-olds. What did this study find?
Let me back up a second. Is 60 to 70% of our work now, of our teams, is in 0 to 3 babies. Chinese has a saying that says, San sui kan lao, at 3 you can see the future. Neuroscience has a saying, it says, by 3, your cognition, your social development, your language skills are mostly developed for the rest of your life. So this old Tang Dynasty saying is actually pretty prescient. We just published a paper in Lancet Global Health, and we find that almost 40 to 50% of rural babies, and this isn't in ethnic minority counties, this is all over central and western China, the Han populations, they basically have cognition levels that really say they're delayed, they're slow. If they were in the U.S., they would be in special ed classes. Of course, there are no special ed classes. So this was at 0 to 3. And so people were saying, is that a big problem or anything? So what we said is, well, if today 40 to 50% of rural kids have low IQs, let's go look at them in rural schools when they're 15, right? If at 3 you see the future, then let's see what they look like at 15. And what we found was 50 to 60% of them were cognitively slow. They basically had levels of cognition, IQs, which makes it almost impossible for them to go to high school and study algebra, trigonometry, computer science, language, high-level language skills. This is almost half of China's future population, and I think that it's a tremendous challenge that China's facing.
Those are extraordinary figures. Now, Mindy, I wanted to ask about your work, which is looking at another aspect of China's attitude towards its rural dwellers. Your research has involved looking at official language. And my journalistic reading of your paper, and I'm really sorry to sum it up so crudely, but you basically find that the state uses peasants as scapegoats, blaming them for all kinds of rural problems. I mean, can you just unpack a bit the kind of language that you found used about China's rural dwellers?
Yeah, I think the clearest expression of that is this idea of rural people being of low quality, or suzhi, right? Having low suzhi, low quality. And this you see repeated in policy documents, but also in just sort of certainly the press, but certainly just in common discourse, right? This notion that peasants and rural people and the rural in general is sort of a backwards place. It's lagging behind, and not only lagging behind, but is sort of a weight on the ability of the rest of the country, let's say, the urban part of the country, to grow and to continue to develop. I mean, one of the places where I found this most clearly was in my work looking at the pork industry and how pig farming transformed from early in the reform era all the way up to the present. But seeing the ways in which the state and also media and again also sort of popular discourse will frame all of the problems, the environmental problems of this massive pork production industry, the food safety problems that are increasingly common, how those will be framed as problems of the peasants or of the smallholder farmers, because they're unruly and they're hard to manage and they're not very standardized, right? And so these problems get laid at the feet of rural people and of peasant farmers in particular, and then the solution is large-scale, industrial, capital-intensive forms of agriculture. So I see the two really going together. You have this sort of easy target to blame, which sets up this grand solution. And we can see that, yeah, throughout the past several decades, and also see it sort of increasing in terms of crises around the recent African swine fever crisis, and even around COVID. These have been moments, sort of disasters or crises, right, where there's further arguments for bringing in modern forms of production.
Mindy, how did they come to be so demonized in official language? In the Mao era, peasants were held up as one of the great stars of the revolution. And even during the reform era, they were held up as early adopters, if you like, of economic reform. How did this discourse about them come to change so rapidly?
I see it as this kind of discourse developing and amplifying really after there starts to be a development focus in urban areas, right? And so kind of after the shift away from township and village enterprises and this era where there was more rural development, let's say, going on, and this need for migrant labor coming from the countryside, but not able to fully leave the countryside, right? That sort of creates this division, I think, in a way, and where the peasants then become seen as the drag because this labor force is so necessary for the kind of economic growth that was happening on the coasts in the cities.
I kind of got a bit dizzy reading your paper, because the documents that you crunched through must have been incredibly dry. These documents and speeches from the late Hu Jintao era, which is, you know, just about peak stodge when it comes to Chinese official writing. And this was meant to be a time when China's leaders were meant to have cared more than any other period about China's rural population. So has this discourse shifted at all under Xi Jinping?
Well, I think there's been a couple of different waves and some changes, right? And I think maybe demonization is maybe too strong, but yeah, this sort of subordination of the rural and of rural people has largely continued and largely been this real push again to industrialize and scale up agricultural production. including through land consolidation, which was really proceeding quite quickly in the 2010s, all the way up to around 2016. There was quite a push from the state to consolidate land as a way to also facilitate larger scale agribusiness and a way also to sort of get rid of the peasant economy. And I think, you know, we can see that that's slowed a bit. So there's a bit of a reversal in 2018 with the rural revitalization strategy that came out in 2018. And here we see a bit of a shift to a more recognition of kind of the rural end of farming as part of the backbone also of Chinese society. And here this land consolidation is slowed in part because migrant labor is starting to come back to villages, right? In relationship to all of the things happening, including COVID more recently, this rural space, and because of hukou, of course, and the land is sort of like a safety net. Hukou is sort of like an internal passport in China. People are registered either as a rural person or as an urban person by their hukou or household registration. And so if you are registered as a rural person, that means that all of your social benefits and social services are also can come to you through the place where you're registered, through your home place. With rural or agricultural hukou, it also means that you are entitled to land, to collectively held land that you then have use rights over. When you have urban hukou, and you live in cities, then again, your social benefits are tied to the city where you live, and you don't have this access to land. You don't have this right to land use. And so even migrant workers who are spending 11 months out of every year working in a city on the coast, let's say, who are from Sichuan province, let's say, they still have their rural hukou. And so while they live in the city and work in the city, they often can't get their medical benefits are not there. Their children often can't go to school in the city. So you have these households that are split, and they're literally, legally, politically split in terms of the things that they can access, the things that they have rights and privileges. So, I mean, one way we can see that is it's a benefit for migrant workers to have rural hukou, because when we have things like financial crises or COVID crises, they, in theory and often in practice, can go home to the village, and there will often still be land there that maybe their parents have been tending or their kids have been tending.
Scott, just hearing Mindy talk about hukou and listening to what you've said, it just strikes me that the outcomes are so drastically different for rural and urban dwellers on every level, you know, health, education, mobility, even the way they're treated in official discourse. And that's all baked into the system, into the structure of society by using hukou. I mean, would it be too extreme to describe it as almost like a kind of location-based state-sponsored apartheid?
Apartheid or caste system? Yeah, at least in India, right, you can move to the cities and buy a house, and, you know, if you're successful and everything. It is this caste system, and it's mostly based on these access to social services. You know, China's education, health, early childhood development, pensions, unemployment insurance, that they're all based on hukou, and they're all based in your local county, and they're all ultimately locally funded. I like to say, I mean, I'm from the United States, and we have one of the most unequal education systems in the whole world, because we have 40,000 school districts that are all locally funded. So if you're in Palo Alto, California, where I'm at, right, the property taxes are so high that, you know, the local school districts, I mean, we hire PhDs for high school teachers, right? But, you know, go 100 miles away to Fresno, California, where, you know, the property prices are almost zero, and there's so many more kids, is that they have horrible, horrible educations and horrible education outcomes. China's just like that. They have 40,000 school districts that are all locally funded. And so it's the difference between Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, where they have some of the greatest school systems in the world. And then you go out to these rural areas where the teachers, you know, barely are educated. There's no incentive for anybody to work hard. They're just this horrible system. I want to say one thing about this hukou system. These farmers have land, but there's not one out of 100 of them that have any interest in farming at all. We did a survey in a big factory in central China that makes a phone that a lot of us use. And we asked 20,000 of those workers what they wanted to do 10 years hence and 20 years hence. Less than one out of 100 said that they wanted to farm. And then we'd say, why not? Well, 98 out of 100 said, I've never farmed a day in my life. Plus, they say, my father farms and I make more in 2 weeks in this factory than he makes in a year. So they don't want to go back. And the thought with rural revitalization is just so absurd that we're going to take 900 million rural people and put them back in their villages. It shows you what common prosperity is really about. It's a strategy that's not thought out at all.
I mean, you just said it shows you what it's really about. What is it really about?
Okay. Well, I don't know what it's really about, as a matter of fact. But let me tell you, till today, there's four main policies that have been rolled out, okay? And two of them are targeted at the rich. And so it's rich individuals are supposed to give lots more philanthropy, and rich companies are going to be taxed heavily, or they're going to be taken over by the state. There's only two policies that the poor half of this income distribution has been said, and that is no welfare and don't lie flat. Don't lie flat is a saying in China, Tongping, which is saying, you know, you have to work really hard. And there's a big cadre of young urban people that live off their parents' largesse, or they get a job and they skate through life. They're not ambitious at all, right? That's called lying flat. But in the press, sometimes it sounds like they're saying these rural people are, you know, lying flat. You know, you have to work harder, rural. But Mindy just told us how hard those guys work. And I mean, since there's no unemployment and there's no Social Security and there's no catastrophic health coverage, I don't know one rural person who lies flat. Rural people are working as hard as they can. And, you know, I think that therein lies the problem is it's this common prosperity isn't thought out, right? Is for common prosperity to happen, China, one, needs to prosper. That means it means it needs to keep going. And commonly means we have to take all these poor people and raise them up to the rich. I haven't heard the strategy for doing that yet. I think that there's a long ways to go before we see if they're going to really take this. I think it's very possibly until now, it's just basically a policy that's been rolled out. So it seems like the government is worried about these poor people.
So Mindy, to transition, I might get you to talk about what do you think the future of Chinese peasantry is? You wrote this paper about the kind of alternatives that have been laid out inside China. For example, rural activism, alternative food networks that kind of link farmers to a wealthy middle class that are concerned about all the chemicals in their food. And more recently, there's been a really interesting contribution by Xiaowei Wang talking about the blockchain chicken farm and this idea of tech incubators appearing in China's countryside. I mean, is there a future for the peasantry here? Can this idea of rural revitalization work in any way?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, maybe first to say, as sociologists, we do talk about peasants as something different than farmers, as a different kind of way of production, let's say, different relationships to markets. I think there's no such thing as self-sufficient peasants, right? To use kind of an overused ideal type. But I do think it makes sense to talk about a peasantry in China as opposed to farmers, let's say, who are more directly engaged in the agricultural modernization that's happening, right? That are more involved in markets, that are behaving, operating a little bit differently. More than that, though, maybe is coming back to also this idea of discourse. And of course, nongmin means something different than a farmer, right? And it carries all of this kind of narrative about backwardness and these subordinate groups of people. So I think there are reasons to talk about peasants in China. I understand that it doesn't work for economists, but yeah, it does work for us. So the future of the peasantry, I mean, this is a big question. On one hand, when I look at the pork industry, because that's where I've spent most time, and kind of industrial agriculture around livestock in general. I mean, those trajectories are for just increasing scale. There are massive pig farms being built in China, the biggest in the world. One of the biggest recently is Muyuan, which is Nanyang in Henan. And they are going to produce 2 million pigs a year on one site. They have these buildings that are six-story buildings, 21 six-story buildings on this one site, and they'll produce 2 million pigs a year.
It's like a skyscraper pig farm.
Yeah, I think the tallest one is in Guizhou, I believe, and it's 12 stories. But Muyuan in Henan, it's 21 six-story buildings full of pigs, so in this one site, and it's the biggest in the world. And this, there's so much policy and financial support for this, coming from the state, but also coming from investors, that, I mean, this is really for sure one of the big stories and one of the big developments that I think will continue. And at the same time, there are these sort of alternatives, let's say, right? There's green production, there's some middle and upper class kind of green and organic kind of foods. But I don't think that's going to, I don't think that, let's say, the peasant farmers, by which I mean poor marginalized farmers, I don't think those farmers are going to become these alternative organic farmers that are supplying all of the food to middle class consumers. So I really, when I think of, you know, what's the future for the peasants, it doesn't seem so bright to me, and yet I don't think that that population is going to go away. I think, in fact, rural people, rural bodies of water, rural bodies of land are really so much a source for economic development in cities and on the coasts. And they're also this sink for all of the crises of this kind of development, right? In terms of reabsorbing migrant workers when there's financial crises, but also in terms of absorbing polluting industries, all kinds of pollution in rural areas. So I don't have the brightest view, I would say.
And Scott, I mean, your predictions seem particularly dark. I mean, I've seen you predicting that an estimated 200 to 300 million workers could be structurally unemployable in the next few decades. And, you know, that's not even talking about the question of IQ and cognitive developmental problems that you've been talking about before. I mean, surely this should be a source of concern as a potential for instability for a government that's obsessed by stability. I mean, what kind of future do you see playing out for these people?
I'm an optimist. And the optimism has been drilled into me at 40 years of reform. And I've seen the economists predict that China was going to fail over and over again. And somehow they move past it. I was never on the prediction side of catastrophe until recently. And I think that they're, you know, I think given the current level of development in China and what needs to happen if China is going to keep growing, I mean, they're upper middle income, and the sources of growth are very, very, you know, limited, right? They're going to need to grow by productivity growth and technology forever if they want to keep growing. And so I think that how this big rural population fits into it, and I just don't see it. I think that, number one, the first thing they need to do is to say, one, let's make sure that future generations, if we make it that far, don't do that. So that's why all of my work is on education, health, early childhood development. That's number one. Number two is, now we need to go back in and see what sort of institutions do we need to get us through this. It's very interesting. If you look at Chinese employment data, what we see now is manufacturing jobs are falling, construction jobs are falling, and agricultural jobs are falling. We aren't having more and more farmers. They're leaving the farm, right? And what are they doing? They're going into one sector, the labor intensive informal service sector. And this is according to China. It's what Li Keqiang himself said in 2020. He said 600 million people live in the gig economy, the farmer's market economy. Right? That's 600 million people rely on this. And so what I say is, you better get the institutions set up to deal with them. How about unemployment insurance? The problem, Mindy, I'm sure you'll agree with me, is they get laid off their urban job. They aren't unemployed because they have a farm to go back to. Well, guess what? No, none of them go back to that farm, right? But they do have a farm to go back to, so they're not unemployed. So there's no unemployment insurance. I think they need to really experiment with adult training. I mean, we have to take these junior high grads and figure out how to give them the skills that they're going to be able to exist in this economy. And I think the other thing I liked what Mindy said is, the future of these really poor, marginalized rural communities isn't in this green, digitalized farm to consumer, but that's the only way they're going to do it. And we need to train them for that. But training a 25-year-old with a kid, they can't work part-time and go to school part-time and learn. You know, we have to have a really serious adult training program, and still half of them aren't going to be able to learn, but the other half will. And so if we're going to move them into fourth and fifth tier cities, there's no way that's going to work. We have to move them into urban areas, integrate them in, and support them. Otherwise, we're going to have massive, massive unrest.
Mindy, would you like to respond?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are coming up, and one is just, I mean, as we hear Scott talk and just in this conversation about rural people and, you know, rural people's opportunities and life chances and all of this, it's also really striking how rural people in China are just considered this sort of malleable group that can be moved around, kind of, okay, now we need migrant workers, so go to the cities. Okay, now the jobs aren't there, so go back to the villages. Okay, now we need to train for this. Now we need to do this. And there's just this sense, I think this is part of the subordination, right? That you have this sort of marginalized population that then you can just sort of pull around and manage, govern, however you like to say, this population for other ends, right? But there isn't much focus on the rural and rural space and rural people as an end in itself, right? And making rural spaces places where people would actually want to live, where they could actually live. It's more about kind of how you use the rural and the rural people. The other thing that I want to say about, this is a little bit back to Hukou, but it's also broader, is that I think it's important to also talk about gender and generational differences when we talk about the workforce and also about Hukou. Because part of what I mean about talking about these peasants, let's say, or about the farming that takes place, is we do have split families where we'll have grandparents and children and maybe a mother in the village, and they might be doing some farming for their own consumption or perhaps to sell, while another member of the family, often male, but not always, of course, is out doing the migrant work. So we also have this spatial and geographic separation of the wage labor component, if you like, and then sort of the care components that still take place in the village where that rural hukou is. And so I think whenever we're talking about labor, we also have to think about the things that produce labor. You know, what is it? Who's feeding workers? Who's educating workers? Who's caring for workers? And then in China, we have to think of that as things that are separated sometimes by thousands of miles and by a lot of policies.
Just to jump in, and this is just something that occurs to me as you guys talk, but it seems like the vision for China's cities is much more like a South Korea, whilst what we're seeing in the countryside is almost like North Korea, right? That divide is getting wider and wider, and there seems to be nothing bridging it. I mean, how can that divide be bridged?
What you have to go look at is the history of every single country in the history of the world that's developed. And everybody moves out of rural areas into the cities. That is, urbanization is everything. China's the only country, besides North Korea, thank you, who's ever tried to keep families in the countryside. Yes, that's rural revitalization. Let's put them back into the countryside. That's never happened anywhere in the history of the world. Why is it? Because the jobs are in the city and the families want to be together, and the schools and the healthcare and the social services are better in the city anyhow. And then once you get everybody to the city, the conglomeration economies drive development forward. There's lots of problems. Every development path has huge problems. Let me tell you a quick story. In Taiwan, what they did, and I know this because the last teacher that taught me Chinese, he was at Taiwan Normal University. He got assigned to a rural school in the suburbs of Taipei. He was assigned to this school, and there was six classes, one class of 20 students for each grade. And he was told, you are going to become the biggest primary school in Asia. And his other friends were told the same thing. And over the next 10 years, they expanded the school, because what they did is they went around Taiwan and said, we would love you to move to Taipei. We want you to move to Taipei. We're going to give you the best schools in the world with the best teachers. And then we're going to give you low-cost housing over here because we want you here, because we want our industrial base to be generated. And that's what happens in South Korea, right? I mean, what's the rural population of South Korea now? 9%? What's the population of Japan? 7%? What's the rural population of Taiwan? I think it's 11%, something like that. The rural population of the U.S. is 20%, but half of those people who live in rural areas actually work in urban areas. But China's doing the exact opposite. They're pushing people back. It's a crazy way to think, and I don't think the Chinese have a real plan for it. They want to move the peasants out of the city to keep the cities clean and neat.
Scott, can I very quickly ask, because I think this is something that's really been missing from our media coverage, not through any fault of journalism, just probably through their lack of access. How has COVID been affecting the Chinese countryside? Because all the stories we get are from urban China, particularly the big cities like Beijing. I mean, how is the rural economy and rural society being shaped by COVID?
I loved in April where they basically said the unemployment rate skyrocketed to 5%. Right. We had a survey of 700 villages outside of Hubei in seven different provinces. And the share of families that had a person working in April of 2020 was less than 20% of had been working in November. So the unemployment rate was probably something like 70%. But of course, they weren't unemployed. They had their farm. And indeed, a lot of them said, well, we'll go back and try to put some plants in the ground and put some. Okay. But by August, almost all men in villages had gone back to work. Women were staying home with their kids. And so the unemployment rate of women was still around 20%, but much lower than the 80% that we saw in there. By the next August, this was last August, almost everyone was back at work, but wages were lower and hours were lower. Most of them have been shifted over to this gig farmers market economy. So there's definitely a negative income effect, though most people are back working.
Mindy, I can almost see the thoughts bubbling up in your head there. Would you like to share some of them?
Going back to this notion of hukou and nobody wants to farm and nobody wants to be in the countryside, I disagree with you in some ways, right? I think this notion that everybody wants to be in the city is a modernist notion that is almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, because when the ways to have a good life only exist in a city, of course, people want to go to a city, right? But that doesn't mean that there's something necessarily better about the city. In fact, in my research, I met a lot of people who didn't want to be migrant workers. They wanted to be in the countryside. They thought of it as a more peaceful life and, you know, that they could spend time doing the things that they want to do. And I also think that you can see sort of people's aspirations for either returning to the countryside if they've left or going to the countryside, which may be based on an overly romanticized idea of what the countryside is. But there is these, you know, there are groups of people who want to have life in the countryside. 生活在农村, right? People kind of romanticizing this. And the sociologist He Shuifeng says you have to make the rural a place where people would want to live. So I just think that this assumption of everybody wants to go to the city, I don't think it's true. I also don't think hukou works in its current form, of course, because it's a complete subordination of the rural to the urban. But I can imagine a situation in which there's some redistribution to the rural, and then not everybody is in a rush to get out of the rural and get out of that lifestyle. And maybe also to come back to the idea of Tangping, which I understand more as a movement of some people who are sort of stepping out and saying, I'm not really interested in this Chinese dream. I'm not really interested in working so hard and getting these material gains. I'm more interested in just having enough and then wanting to have the kind of life that I want to have. So not about laziness necessarily, but sort of about saying, well, this isn't really working. I didn't see it working for my parents. They worked their whole lives. They still didn't have the house that they wanted. And in a way, this is related, right? It's that not everybody is motivated by money. Not everybody is motivated by material possessions. And Tang Ping, I think, is starting to, you know, I'm not saying that everybody's going to take this idea, but it's there, right? And the state is not very excited about it because it's now, you know, removed from Chinese social media. So I just want to question a few of those assumptions that we tend to take as truths, but I think there's a bit more nuance beneath them.
Scott, would you like to respond?
Well, I think I made my point clear. Maybe in some post-industrial society where everybody has 5G internet and they can sit out in their village in the mountains of eastern Hunan or, you know, the Tibetan foothills, right? Economic development is equated to urbanization, okay? And there's been 75 countries become high income, and 75 countries have urbanized, have done that through urbanization. And there's not one country that has more than 10% of its population in the rural areas, okay? So I just don't think that's unusual. Now, you know, in the United States now, right, a farming family makes twice as much as what an urban family makes, right? But it's 1% of our population. What's 1% of our population?
I think if you count debt on that, that statement gets a little more complicated,
right? Per capita income of U.S. farmers is twice that of urban people. But that's because they're so huge. They're farming in the Midwest. They're farming on an average of 10,000 acres each, right? I mean, they're big business, but they're individual family farms. We're going way beyond that. What my point is until we have a really total post-industrial society, you know, with universal income and ways to support this, we don't want to move 600 million people back to villages. It's not going to work. What are they going to do?
I mean, I guess one of the points is that we can say that in 75 countries, economic development has meant urbanization. We can say that, I'm sure that's true. But isn't the question about, you know, and I'm not saying that the Chinese state is going to solve all of the problems, but isn't the question also about does that work? Because global inequality and within-country inequality is off the charts, right? So if we're thinking about actually other ways to organize economies and lives and where people live, I mean, maybe we're not just stuck with, well, this is how development has looked in the past, so it's necessarily going to follow that trajectory again. And I think especially rethinking that in terms of the sort of ecological base that it takes and has taken to make this form of economic development. And I think we can all agree that the assuredness of that base of production is less sure in these days.
I want to finish off by looking forwards a little bit as to sort of what happens next. The points you really have in common is there seems to be this sort of huge disconnect between the idea of rural revitalization and the fact that the countryside at the moment is almost uninhabitable because of the lack of opportunity, the educational structural inequalities, and, you know, this pollution crisis as well, the environmental problems. And yet there is this idea of rural revitalization. I mean, how do those two come together? Or are we likely to see sort of mass unrest? Mindy, let's start with you and then Scott.
Yeah, well, as far as I can understand, it seems rural revitalization is probably more about bringing more big business and investment to rural areas. And again, that's what I know from livestock farming in particular. And so we can see lots and lots of investment and capital flow into the countryside, but we have to look where it's going. And it's going into big agribusiness firms, which don't necessarily equate to gains for rural people. So in the farm I mentioned, Muyuan, which is going to raise 2 million pigs a year, on that site, there's only 5,000 jobs. And I should mention that those 5,000 jobs include everything from the pig production to the office staff to the feed production. So this is a really low labor activity, and it's also a highly mechanized activity. And I think this is also a big part of the story is the tech that's coming in, right? And the tech, which also is replacing human labor, not completely, but in many cases. And in agriculture, especially around issues like disease transmission and food safety, kind of tech and robotics are really seen as a solution. So yeah, rural revitalization to me sounds much more like rural agricultural industrialization.
So what's in store? Well, first of all, I don't think the policy on rural revitalization is going to go very far, but I think that they're going to be investing in fourth and fifth tier cities. The plan in the 13th, 14th, five-year plan, you know, they're trying to say, we want to create 2,000 fourth and fifth tier cities. Those are county seats, right? That have 200,000 people in each one of them. That would be home for 400 million people. And they're close to their village. And the people from the villages can come in and that type of thing. Isn't that urbanization? Well, then I start thinking, you know, how does that work? Terry Sickler has a great paper, a set of papers with her colleagues on the rise of the middle income class in China. And it's now 350 million people. There are more middle income people in China than in Europe. But they lack the point out in that paper that there's 1 billion or more low income people. All right. So who's going to move out to these fourth and fifth tier cities? Low income people, right? I mean, because all the middle income people are all in the first and second tier cities. What drives the economy out there? You know, is it manufacturing? They're not going to manufacture there. And a little construction, but that's going to be over. So it's going to be services. Well, wait a minute. If everybody, we know very clearly that people with low incomes don't consume services, right? They got to save. They do it themselves, right? To Louise's question, this is what I think is going to happen is I look at Marty White's work from Harvard. You know, for 20 years, 25 years, he followed the Chinese population. You know, it has one of the highest inequalities in the world. We've been talking about this. And he went to the poorest sort of tier and says, do you know that there's inequality in China? And everybody says, yes, we know there's inequality in China. Does that bother you? And these people in this lower tier would say, no, you got to understand, I'm better off than I was 10 years ago. I'm better off than my parents were. And then they say, I think I'm going to be better off in the future. And that's what's kept the glue that's China. And of course, that's true for all of them. What I worry about, we have a paper that's called The Rise of Polarization. This is the whole idea that I just said after COVID, but it happened before COVID, is hours and wages were starting to fall. And it's especially as people got dumped into the service sector. And if people start saying, oh, I don't see in the next 10 years, I don't see what my future is. It's going to get worse and worse. That's when people are going to start questioning stuff. 500 million people are going to be in this basket. 400 million of them are going to say, well, I'm just going to suck it up and work hard and, you know, churkhoo, right? Eat some bitterness and just keep going. But I think there's going to be a subset of those, including the 40 million unmarried men who are going to say, you know, this is not right, right? Yeah, I don't want to work for nothing and more and more and less. And, you know, it's what it happens in every one of these middle income countries when polarization happens is you get the rise of organized crime. And they say, well, could this happen in China? China created organized crime 4,000 years ago, right? And I think that it would definitely reappear. I think there'd be a battle with the government, with the police force. And who's going to win? I don't know. But I think that there's huge possibility of of rise of crime and you know, really the breakdown of social stability over the next 10 to 20 years.
Scott, I guess the consolation is that it won't affect the urban crime statistics because it will be done by rural people.
Well, thank you guys so much. That was fascinating.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks.
I'm Grant Smith, and you've been listening to the Little Red Podcast, bringing you China from beyond the Beijing Beltway. Many thanks to our guests, Scott Rozelle and Mindy Schneider, and to my co-host, Louisa Lin. Editing for this episode was by Andy Hazel, background research by Wing Kwong, our theme music is by Susie Wilkins, and cartoons and GIFs are courtesy of Seb Danta. Bye for now.